Take a network break. Pre-game your Thanksgiving feast with a dozen virtual donuts and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me, of course, is Greg Farrow.
Hello.
Hello. Today's show is sponsored in part by ExtraHop, the leader in real-time IT analytics. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. Tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers. That'll get you a free t-shirt, and you can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself at extrahop.com/demo. Network Break is also sponsored by InterOptic. You can purchase high-performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost. Get more information at connect.interoptic.com/packetpushers and tune into Packet Pushers Weekly Show 360, and you can hear InterOptic CEO Tim Dixon as he opines about transceivers, the Shannon limit, and the future of optics in the data center. All right, to the news. Facebook has released its OpenR software as an open source project. Facebook runs this OpenR routing platform in its backbone and data center networks, and now it's making it available to the world.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Hey.
So excited about this. I mean, if you follow along on the Packet Pushers on the other channels, like on the weekly show or in the priority queues, you'll have heard me talk quite a bit about OpenR, especially about a year ago when it sort of first surfaced over at Facebook. Petr Lapukov has been developing it for a couple of years now. I was so excited when they started talking about it publicly because I'm very excited. Basically, the idea is that instead of using 30-year-old routing protocols, you know, designed in the 1960s and sort of mooted in the 1970s, things have moved on since then, people in networking. You know, OpenR sort of turns a lot of those ideas of how you want your network to self-configure itself. What I mean by that is the way a routing protocol works is it exchanges databases, and then from those databases, it decides, builds up a model of what the configuration should look like, and then the router self-configures itself from the routing database, right? Well, OpenR changes the way this works. Instead of using these arcane models that, you know, literally date back to the 70s, to modernize this and start to run an arbitrary messaging routine that can be on devices. So instead of being stuck with protocols like OSPF and BGP, we can replace them with a true messaging bus. And so what we're now seeing is that OpenR runs already, as Facebook puts into the blog post, runs on Arista and is already working with Juniper QFX and PTF platforms using gRPC, that's Google's remote procedure call protocol, for APIs. This is going a bit further forward than just here's an open source code. This is actually implemented in some vendors. I think this is really exciting. I'm confident, increasingly confident, that over a period of years, it's not going to suddenly leap out and then, you know, whatever, that OpenR will replace routing protocols in many networks. So go over here, read up on this. Don't rush over. It's not like it's going to happen this year. But I think over a 2, 3, 4, 5 year period, I think that we'll see this replace OSPF especially. Because really, the data that we want to exchange between neighboring devices in a network isn't just subnets anymore. We need to start sharing much richer data. What about access control lists? What about device configuration? What about more than VERFs? What about SDN-like configuration? What about IPsec VPN configurations? Not MPLS VPN configurations, but far richer data sets. And that's what OpenR is letting us to do. You can have the OpenR as a messaging plane, but above that, it could be something else. Now, I still believe that BGP and OSPF will exist, but you'll have OpenR to BGP translators or interfaces. So you'll be able to talk to your OpenR using BGP, and your OpenR instance might be a BGP speaker. So imagine if your route reflector not only speaks BGP to legacy devices or to other people's networks, third parties, for example, but internally it might speak OpenR for a much richer environment. That's where I think it's headed today. Some links in the show notes about where you can look at the Facebook blog post about this. And I've also put a YouTube video in where Petr Lapukov, who works at Facebook and is one of the key people behind this, he has a YouTube where he spoke at CHINOG, that's the Chicago NOG, just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, so we'll have a link to the Facebook blog post that gives a little bit more detail about OpenR. Also a link to the GitHub repository where you can actually go and get OpenR for yourself and look at the documentation. What I think is interesting is we've had open source routing for a while, but now we've got folks like Facebook, and then there's an effort with Cumulus there behind the free range routing protocol, which is a split or a fork of Quagga. It's these companies coming in and trying to innovate and disrupt and actually sort of, it feels like breathe new life into making some competition for the vendors who are, you know, pushing traditional routing protocols and routing platforms on the market. Somebody like Facebook has the capacity to say, we're going to essentially do it our own way and then release it to the public and kind of disrupt the traditional model. We've already seen them do it with the Open Compute Project, and now here's OpenR, another example.
Yeah, only a vendor would call this an innovation or a disruption, though.
Of course.
You know, so I'm going to pull you up on that point. You know, and this literally is Facebook had a problem that couldn't solve with BGP or, you know, any of the existing stuff. So they went and invented something that works for them. And in this announcement, it's very clear that, you know, Arista's already running this because they're selling these boxes to Facebook, right?
Yeah.
And the Juniper platforms that presumably the QFX and the PTX, Facebook's buying some of those too. And keep in mind, too, we've also seen a number of other protocols come into the networking space that weren't historically there. Look at Quick, Chrome, and is now replacing HTTP with UDP and replacing HTTP with Quick because it just doesn't want to do the old way. And it's been able to move an entire market in a relatively short period of time. And they've even gone to the IETF to help that, but they would have done it without the IETF, I do rather suspect. And look at, you know, gRPC, Google's RPC, or a way to talk to networking devices as an API that's not, you know, something. It was going to take us years to define an API that networking device. And now all of a sudden we've got a protocol for that. And Yang is getting traction. I don't think many people like Yang, but they're going to live with it because that's the one that's built up some momentum. So, you know, why not OpenR? Why can't we throw away BGP and OSPF inside, like replace your IGP with OpenR? You know, you may still speak BGP on the internet and, you know, but outside, ultimately today you use a route reflector to basically configure all the devices. Why wouldn't you just replace the route reflector with an OpenR instance and get a much richer, much better system? And again, not today, but over the years ahead, I think this is going to take off.
Right.
I'm going to put that in the spreadsheet. I'll bet on that.
Sure. All right. We'll put that on the spreadsheet. And I also want to note, I understand Facebook isn't doing this out of the goodness of their heart or because they love the networking community so much, they just wanted to give them a gift. They have a clear business imperative behind this. Obviously, it made sense for their business to develop this platform, to get it to do what it needs to do. And then by opening it to the public, they also hope to build a community around it that attracts vendor support, that attracts developers to it, that attracts folks to come and think about new ways to use it. And so in the end, Facebook benefits.
It reduces the cost of recruiting. So,
right,
you know,
right, right. They can go maybe attract some network engineers to their fold.
Yeah, so, if you want a job at Facebook, start getting in, you know, read up on OpenR so you can pass the internet.
Right. Right?
But, you know, keep in mind here, you know, as the announcement talks, you know, it's in Arista, it's in the Juniper gear today.
Yep. Yeah. It's for real. Yep.
So by open sourcing it, that's the easiest way to get vendors to bring it in, right? They've got no excuse not to put it in.
Right.
Unless maybe you're Cisco and they think that it's not invented here. Or if you're some other vendor and you say, well, we didn't invent that. If you've got that sort of mentality, you're going to have to probably change that because open source takes it away. You can't not do it, really.
Right. Right. And I think Facebook has the muscle to kind of move this thing along without an organization like the IETF or IEEE behind it even. They've got the wallet, the pocketbook.
Yeah, I don't think Facebook will ever take it to the IETF. Maybe one of the other vendors, maybe Juniper or, you know, would or Arista could. But I think for the time being, it's in the open source. If now it's up to customers to, you know, for people to latch onto it. And if that happens, then the IETF will follow on and somebody will take it through the process there, somebody who knows what's going on. I think, as I said, I think this is substantial. You know, it's already been through several years of development. It's based on existing tool chains. There's no reason why this wouldn't get adopted, in my view. So I'd back it. I'll bet on it.
All right. So we've got a bet in the spreadsheet. Moving on, Qualcomm's board of directors have rejected Broadcom's acquisition. A press release issued by Qualcomm states, Broadcom's proposal significantly undervalues Qualcomm relative to the company's leadership position in mobile technology and our future growth prospects. I interpret that as it wasn't a big enough offer.
Well, we did say last week that Apple's been playing argy-bargy with Qualcomm and threatening to walk away from Qualcomm's modems. And that, you know, the share price was down 20% on the back of that. So, of course, Qualcomm thinks that it's going to be able to bounce back from that and we want a better offer. And ultimately, yeah, that was always on the cards. The flip side of this is Broadcom promptly announced Qualcomm rejected the bid. Broadcom then announced that they remained fully committed to the acquisition of Qualcomm. And then the board rejected the bid and said, we want more money. Just the normal argy-bargy, nothing. There's nothing here to really pay any attention to because, you know, whatever. Really, it's going to be Qualcomm's going to have to show that it's worth more than it is at the moment because, and it's largely going to be because of Apple.
Right.
Because that's what's driven their share price down and make this an opportunistic takeover, I think.
Right. Yeah, just a little update, and we'll probably be back with more news as this goes forward. But right now, it's Qualcomm saying no.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, next story. Rackspace and HPE are partnering to offer a managed private cloud based on OpenStack that can run on the customer premise, in a colo, or in a Rackspace data center.
I thought you said OpenStack was dead.
I never said that. Hey, don't pin that on me.
OpenStack's dead. You can't use OpenStack to build a private cloud. Isn't that what the vendors all told us? They said OpenStack will never. Anyway. Makes sense. I think that OpenStack is, there are customers who, for whom, which OpenStack is absolutely the thing. We're seeing the recent OpenStack conference, lots of stories coming out there. I still think OpenStack's got some maturing to do and to simplification, but getting somebody like Rackspace to build a, you know, turnkey private cloud based around OpenStack and then HPE out there selling it takes away the hard part for Rackspace. Rackspace hasn't been able to find customers. So this is a good partnership. Probably gives HPE a way to migrate out Helion customers, if there's some of those left, if they haven't migrated out already. This might be a good strategy for keeping those customers happy who wanted that and want to continue being HPE customers, and HPE doesn't want to let them go.
Right, Helion was HPE's OpenStack distro, right?
That's right. It was a distro, and it was also a private cloud, a hosted cloud. And this has a smacks of... There's some customers on Helion saying, well, what are you going to do to fix, make us whole?
Yeah, we wrote a bunch of applications for this.
That's right. maybe not. I could be being unkind, but I think there's multiple targets being hit here. OpenStack will continue to slowly mature. The trick here is going to be, can OpenStack come in soon enough before Azure Stack and VMware's private cloud aspirations kill that market off?
Well, there's been a lot of uptake, I think, in OpenStack on the service provider and carrier side. So I don't know that OpenStack necessarily needs the enterprise to survive. But yes, there's considerable competition coming. What strikes me about this release and this partnership is that it's going to be single tenant. So when you set up this private cloud, whether in your own data center or in Rackspace or wherever, you want all the hardware. You're not going to be sharing it with anyone, which on one hand sounds great. But one of the whole premises behind public cloud is that you bring costs down by multi-tenancy, because when you've got dedicated hardware, you have costs, because if you're going to, you know, burst or increase capacity, you've got to buy the hardware ahead of time to have that capacity. And if you're in a single tenant environment, I'm just curious who's eating that hardware cost up front to sort of have that extra capacity sitting around not doing anything when you're talking about a single tenant environment.
There are companies for whom spending capital is the right way to do business, as we saw with VMware on AWS, which we've talked about, which is exactly this model. You go in and you rent X number of hardware servers inside of AWS's data centers. And then you literally install VMware on them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
VMware on AWS, right?
Right? That's right.
It literally is a VMware, you know, vRealize deployment in AWS's data centers. That's it. That's all it is. And that this is the same model. So I would say to you, put it to you, that if VMware on AWS is a successful business model, enough for VMware to throw scads of cash at it and, you know, put it up as a keynote and so on and so forth, then this is an OpenStack version of that. And there's somebody out there who wants it. Who are we to judge? I'm not.
This is a non-judgmental episode of Network Break.
You know, there's multiple genders. Why aren't there multiple private clouds?
All right, very good. We'll have links to the Rackspace blog if you want to go find out more details, but that's the news from HPE and Rackspace.
Lovely.
All right, just a quick break to tell you about one of our sponsors today. That's ExtraHop. They are the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data. That is the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment, from your data center to the edge to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For too long, IT has thought of the network either as just plumbing or a problem. But with ExtraHop, the network becomes the biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does the analysis first and then stores packets. This creates wired data, which encompasses all interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective. Analyzing it at scale transforms the network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. With ExtraHop, companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, Netflix, and Expedia save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times by more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. If you want to learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, you can visit them at extrahop.com/demo. You can connect with them on Twitter as @ExtraHop, and if you mention Packet Pushers, you'll receive a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT.
Oh, just a quick point there. You talked a lot about wire data in that.
Yeah.
Don't forget that ExtraHop is able to collect wire data from cloud wires. That is, you can put agents into the public clouds and still collect the data on the wire and still do the same analysis. It's not something that we actually called out here, but I actually think it's really important to understand you can use ExtraHop not only in your private cloud or in your physical data center, you can also use it in the public cloud.
All right, an extra note there. Thank you. Back to the news. The French cloud provider OVH suffered a serious data center outage at a location in Strasbourg, France. A power outage took down the entire campus. The company CEO wrote a post that noted a motorized failover system did not cut the data centers over to alternative power supplies.
Yes, well, and I have dug out an image of an email that the CEO sent out, which is actually debugging the situation.
Yeah.
Apparently, the real story is, and here's my favorite, back in 2011, we planned the deployment of new data centers in Europe. And then basically he goes on to say, you know, we half-assed the deployment. We dropped some containers in and we didn't really worry too much about the power.
And by containers, you actually mean shipping containers, not a Docker instance. A shipping container, their containerized data centers were a thing for a little while.
Yeah, it was all the fashion, you know, a bit like black is the new black, you know, sort of thing.
Right, you shove a bunch of racks inside a container and you can stack them up and power them, and then you've got your instant data center. That was the idea, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so the thing is, that, you know, they thought, well, we'll launch this data center and see if customers actually turn up. So we won't actually build it. We won't worry too much about the power and, you know, we'll sort of half-ass it. And then what I said is, you know, so then we built another data center, but then it actually filled up. So then we built a third data center, and then it filled up as well.
Oh, crap,
so
we it's working.
Actually, oh, crap. And so we couldn't actually turn the power off in the old data center and fix it. So, you know, as he says here, we made two mistakes. We did not make the SPG site compliant with internal standards, which require two separate electrical M feeds, which are clipped with dual feeds, which we should have done. And when we built the data center from the other one, they made a mistake in the design of them. So basically, we half-assed the design of our data centers and we got nailed. Sound familiar? That certainly sounds like just about every enterprise data center I ever worked in. So, you know, I don't want to criticize them here. AWS got caught out. You know, they've had a couple of outages due to power where, you know, substations have blown up and taken down the entire power infrastructure. So, you know, and power is enormously hard. But it does sound like, we didn't really want to commit to the clouds. We half-assed it, and now we've been caught out. So not a good look, really, is it?
It's definitely not a good look, considering the number of customers that were affected and for how long.
Yeah.
I guess the lesson is here, always full asset if you can.
Yeah, temporary. There's no such thing as temporary in IT infrastructure. It's always permanent. We already hit on it a bit, but you know, it did remind me there was actually a picture in the blog post of these containers stacked on top of each other, and I was going like, wow, remember when they were a thing?
That's right.
They're all going to be in containers by now, and I just thought, you know, I really thought that containers was going to be the and then public clouds come along and just made it pointless. So there you go. I probably got that one wrong, actually.
Oh, I don't know if we ever had a spreadsheet item on that. If whoever's managing the spreadsheet can go and look, we'll figure
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, you know, I really felt that containers as data centers was really going to be the way that it was going to work. I think a couple of things came along. One was virtualization, which took away the need for extra space inside your data center. A lot of companies I've spoken to have had, like, you know, been through and virtualized everything in their data center and rationalized everything. And now all of a sudden their data center is 70% empty. So we didn't need containers after all.
Right.
Faster CPUs, bigger storage. All of a sudden, we don't need the extra space.
There you go. And this is thinking about last week when we talked about the CenturyLink Level 3 outage. The big takeaway here is that humans are still an issue, and that, you know, as much as we can scale the cloud and data centers, power is still the limiting factor.
You know, we've said before in different shows, we're seeing a lot of these hosting companies and cloud companies get into power because power is hard. There's a big Barney going, like Apple in Ireland, in having big arguments with the local power supplier and the government. They want to buy all the power output, and the power company doesn't want to give it to them. And then Apple wants to build a solar plant, and then the company, you know, the local council won't let them build, you know, power generation. And these clouds are really going to struggle with power, just getting, you know, hundreds of megawatts of power to run these things.
Because they're reliable.
Yeah, because keep in mind, it takes 10 years to build a nuclear power, you know, 20 years to build a nuclear power station. It takes 15 years to build coal, but nobody wants to be building coal-fired power stations or gas power stations when solar and wind is coming in. There's actually not much power left in the first world as we go through the transition. So, yeah, lots of interesting problems around power.
All right. I'm sure we'll be talking about this again. Moving on, though, AT&T, they are battling the Justice Department because the Justice Department is trying to block AT&T's proposed $85 billion acquisition of Time Warner. Bloomberg has like a really good article about why AT&T is pushing this fight. Apparently, it's all about gathering data on viewing habits so that AT&T can build a more precise and profitable ad network.
So now your network is actually just a data set for ad networks. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, that's right.
The greatest right. minds of our generation are focused on getting another ad in front of our faces.
We built this internet so that it could serve you more targeted ads. How does that feel?
Yeah. So previous predictions, as I've said, we talked about Verizon buying Yahoo before. And why did they buy Yahoo? Because they can get greater targeting. I mean, think about what Verizon's got. For subscribers who are on the Verizon network, whether you're mobile phone or landline, it knows who you are, where you live, how much you earn, you know, it knows details about your house, and then it knows what you look at on the internet. It's actually scanning your traffic on the internet and attaching that to your user profile. So if you're a Verizon customer hitting a Yahoo website, those ads are, you know, or Yahoo ad related stuff, and or Verizon is selling that data to someone else anyway. So AT&T wants a piece of that business. I've said before that that's a multi-tens of billions of dollars industry. It's probably up around the $60 or $70 billion mark now. So we're actually could be heading to the point where net neutrality is not a thing. And the way these big carriers are going to monetize their networks has actually just become data points for ads. What a time to be alive.
Those are advertising wins. I mean, they've got to be looking at the revenues of Google and Facebook, which are astonishing, and they are all essentially based on advertising, and thinking, what are we, chumps? We got to get a piece of this.
Well, you know, the problem, of course, is that Facebook and Google capture all that data, and AT&T and Verizon get none of it.
Right. Well, they get some of it, but they don't. They're missing out on pieces of it.
That's right. And as they get commoditized, and they're thinking, well, if they could build their own ad networks or their own data sources, which is exactly what Facebook and Google have, then they can get you, you know, and then they can capture some of that luscious, luscious ad revenue. Huzzah.
My question is, I wonder how granular they can get, because TV is essentially still a broadcast medium. Like, if I'm watching the same show as my neighbor across the street, is AT&T's network going to get smart enough to serve me a separate ad from my neighbor based on our habits and interests? I don't know if they can get there. I mean, that would be scary, but I'm sure very lucrative for AT&T, but I don't know that they could actually get to that place.
So smart TVs are already heading down that path. Somebody was, so this isn't in the show notes, and I don't think I could find it again, but there was an article that slid by my RSS feed this week about smart TVs being able to dynamically replace ads in your television.
Okay, never mind. There it
the
is.
The code's actually there. They just haven't turned it on yet.
Oh, great. Huzzah.
So, yes, they can.
Okay. Question answered. Why did I doubt? Silly me.
Yeah, that's right. Remember, the greatest minds of our generation are working on showing you ads.
Okay. Bring it on. A report from the analyst firm IHS Market is forecasting that the SD-WAN market is going to grow to $3 billion by the year 2021, and that is up from $137 million today.
Well, that's the roulette wheel of how big the SD-WAN market's going to grow. What was it a year ago? Was it $16 billion? 20?
Yeah, there were a lot of numbers floating around, anywhere from like $3 billion to $20 billion, and yes, there was a lot of excitement.
Yeah, well, you know, like, whatever. I'm not sure that this, you know, $3 billion, $6 billion, $10 billion, I actually think that SD-WAN is a collapsing market, in that increasingly the routers at your branch are actually just going to be a way to connect your branch office to cloud services. So if you are using Google Docs or Microsoft Office 365 or Microsoft Mail in Azure, quite what the role of the SD-WAN is going to be is I'm starting to question it, right? Just long term, how big this market can be, or whether we just start. I still think there's definitely a market for SD-WAN. We definitely need to connect our data center to our branches, but just how big is that market and how many people are actually just going to move it all to the cloud? I'm not sure it's, you know, we'll talk about Cisco's financial results a bit later on. They're still selling $7 million worth of switches and routers, $7 billion.
Right. Right. Well, so I looked up some numbers. IDC put the worldwide router market at $15 billion back in 2016. So when you look at $3 billion compared to $15 billion, obviously a 5 times difference. But it seems like, you know, that the router market may be on a downward curve. The SD-WAN market is on an upper curve. So maybe SD-WAN will start to take over some of that routing revenue, and we could see it grow a little bigger. People are going to need a box to do something somewhere at the edge of the branch. And of course, deep in the core network as well, and also for carriers and service providers. So routing's still going to be around, but the size of the market for SD-WAN, $3 billion, sounds about right to me.
Yeah, I think ultimately I was chatting to a vendor product manager the other day, and he actually sort of made the comment that he thinks that SD-WAN is not actually going to be a thing for vendors because it's just what's left of the enterprise router market. You know, once you have SD-WAN, it's actually destructive overall because it makes routers cheaper. And the only people who win out of SD-WAN is the customers and not the vendors. And I smiled and thought, yay for us, finally. I do believe that. I think that, you know, where you have a branch router today that's costing you $20,000 to buy and $10,000 a year to maintain, you're probably going to be looking at something like $5,000 and $2,500. You know, you can and get far better services, far better value for money. It shouldn't cost you what it costs you now. It should be half the price or less because routers should have gotten much cheaper over the last 20 years, which they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Router vendors have been able to maintain high prices in the face of all evidence to say that they should be getting cheaper and faster and better, just like x86 servers. And this is probably that coming home to roost, perhaps.
I think so. All right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor for today. That is Interoptic.
Ah, and that's because people tend to buy transceivers from their vendor who made your switch because they've been told if they buy non-vendor branded optics, God will kill a cute, pretty little kitty.
Oh, no.
But you do have legitimate options for optics, and no kittens have to die, not even the cute ones. So our sponsor, Interoptic, just loves the cute little kittens, and they think that if they have some optics that you'll want to buy, you can purchase the same, if not better performing optics, but are designed by engineers who love the optics. And they understand what you need and can do it at a fraction of the cost. Now it's time to take control of your optics purchase. Interoptic stands behind the optics they sell. They'll give you a better price, and they'll also give you the code that runs on the SFPs that should be updated from time to time. So if you're ever having problems, if you ever want to run an optic from one switch into another switch, you can actually get the code and update it. And so you don't actually have to put in, you know, I've got a bad optic or whatever. And this suppresses all the alarms and simplifies things for you. Now, so you can choose OEM equivalent optics from Interoptics, whether you're doing campus, data center, 5G, IoT. If you're not doing your optics correctly, you're going to be overwhelmed. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero. What they mean by nimble is they mean with this optic can go in this brand of switch, or this brand of switch. Maybe you have to flash some code to make it work, but you only have to have one spare part in stock, not one for each vendor. From a hut in the Arctic Circle to the battlefield in Iraq. That's a big claim, isn't it?
Sure is.
Interoptic has more than 4,000 customers across 7 continents. Visit connect.interoptic.com/packetpushers and contact them directly to the quote. Make sure you use that link. That helps out the packet pushers, and that helps Interoptic feel like packet pushers is worthwhile. And that would be a good thing for us. And you can also follow Interoptic on the socials as @getinterconnect. So again, connect.interoptic.com/packetpushers and get a quote.
All right. Thanks, Interoptic. Back to the news. Here's a rather big pill to swallow from Adobe. The company rolled out patches for Flash and Acrobat and Reader, the latter of which had 56 vulnerabilities.
Not just 56 vulnerabilities, 56 really, really bad ones.
Yeah, critical. Critical remote execution.
Yeah, like I can hack your Adobe and remotely execute code. This is really, you should not be running anything from Adobe inside the firewall. Not Adobe Reader, not Adobe Acrobat, not Adobe apps, because they're just insecure. How many times have we seen this thing come up with, you know, Showstopper, Class Zero, remote execution? It just cannot be safe to run Adobe products in your enterprise environment.
It's scary.
That's all I want to say.
Yeah. Okay. Very good.
56.
56.
In one patch.
That should say it all. All right. Last month, we had talked about Amazon debuting a new service called Amazon Key that lets a delivery driver unlock your house via a digital key to drop off packages. And there's a video camera included in the service, so it records the delivery to give the consumer a little bit of a safe feeling. Now, some researchers at Rhino Labs have found a vulnerability in the camera that lets an attacker either disable the camera or freeze the image, and it represents a potential exploit so that a rogue driver could deliver a package and then leave the residence, not lock the door, execute this vulnerability, then go back inside and steal something.
You know, at this point, do you actually think IoT vendors are actually bothering with testing at all? You know, it's like, I just get the sense at the moment that they're like, yeah, looks okay, just ship it. Well, somebody out there will find a vulnerability. Why would we bother to test it? Let's just put it out there and see, get some free testing. Why would we, you know, do good stuff?
The cynical part of my brain is saying, sure, outsource the vulnerability testing to the researchers and the attacker community, and then we'll fix it later.
Sure, and it's not like anybody's going to care. It's not like customers are going to go, yeah, well, what, we expected that. Sure, we knew it was insecure, fine. You know, it's not like this is even making the press. It's like, you know, and look, hey, we got free testing of our box. Good thing we didn't overinvest in developing a decent product, because that would have been like waste.
And just from what I understand from the Wired story, it looks like the attack essentially spoofs the homeowner's router and sends a deauthorization command to kick the camera off the Wi-Fi. So they aren't actually exploiting any bugs in the camera software or in the lock mechanism system or the authorization system that lets someone in the house. It's essentially a Wi-Fi attack.
So?
I guess part of what it means is there's a whole bunch of software that still needs to be probed and tested and exploited in systems. And so, hooray, have a lot of fun.
It's like the crack attack for Wi-Fi last week. You know, there was two phases to the encryption, but nobody tested two of them together.
That's right.
Doesn't matter. Right? It's still insecure.
Yeah. Yes, expecting to see more from Amazon Key as we go forward. You had talked about Cisco. They released their financial results this week, and they reported their latest quarterly results. Here's some highlights. Revenues of $12.1 billion. That's down 2% year over year. Net income of $2.4 billion, which is up 3% year over year.
Oh, and shareholders are absolutely delighted. Cisco's finally stopped 9 quarters of decline. Finally announced some good profits up. Even though revenue was down, so they continue their quarterly decline in revenue, profits are up. So the share price promptly spiked 4 or 5%, which has made people, the question is, can they actually now deliver on this? And historically, they've been pretty good at delivering on anything that they promised, so everybody's pretty popular with that. One of the things that I noted here is that they've decided to change around how they declare. So before, they used to call it routers, and there'd be a line item and how many routers we sold, and switches, and then servers, and blah, blah, blah. Now there's just infrastructure platforms, which is all very Apple. You know, it's like, I'm starting to think that Cisco's looking at Apple and going, you know, I think there's lots of ideas we can steal. We don't actually want to, you know. So now Cisco classes its categories as infrastructure platforms, applications, security, other products, and services. Infrastructure platforms is routers, switches, servers, you know, collaboration, anything that's kind of like a hardware infrastructure. That still saw a 4% shrinkage. And I think for the network break audience, that's the number that you need to focus on. Because what it means is that routers and switches are still shrinking in terms of dollars. And Cisco, I'm beginning to think that Cisco's moving very rapidly into this licensing model, not so much to, you know, change things out or whatever. I think it's trying to capture as much revenue as possible using software licensing. And potentially we could see them take this too far and move to rent extraction. So if you're not a smart customer moving away from Cisco or just want to keep doing what Cisco encourages you to do, you might be in a situation where you're in a rent capture where the products are just basically trying to lock you in at the existing price point and you're not going to get in any benefits of decreasing price over time. And so, which is fine. I've said plenty of times that nobody in enterprise IT actually cares much about how much something costs. Just be aware of that if you are at a company which is genuinely wanting to reduce costs, you probably want to be very carefully looking at how you can make sure that you're getting the benefits of reductions in commodity items. George Notter from Jefferies in his research note said that Cisco is doubling down on end-to-end selling. He says he's impressed by the organization's strategic push towards an even more architectural sale via the integration of security, analytics, and services across the unified portfolio of products. So customers who are all Cisco, all end-to-end, buys whatever Cisco tells them to, that sort of very, very common strategy in enterprise IT, that is actually capturing revenue and increasing Cisco's bottom line. The converse of that is that you're also, your company is actually paying more for the same stuff that it was buying before, no?
You're a captured customer, yes.
You're a captive customer and you're going to capture it in the butt. So I do think there's a few things. Infrastructure declined by 4%, the vast majority of the decline driven by routing products. So Cisco's struggling to sell routers to service providers. It's driven by continued weakness in service provider and a slowdown in enterprise routing. I think that's SD-WAN. But he did say the bright switching revenue was down, but good momentum in campus switching, which is the network intuitive, which is the SD access stuff, and good strong wireless revenue and a solid uptake of our HyperFlex. So if you think that the future of the network is in networking, that's probably not the case. I think Cisco's seeing good profits in wireless, converged infrastructure, you know, Jasper.
Security as well. Security was up for them. Yeah.
Yeah. So the future is elsewhere. Start thinking about how that might impact you. It doesn't mean it'll impact you today, but over time, the configuration of networks is clearly dying pretty quickly. and the future's in software monitoring, analytics, or troubleshooting above the line.
All right, that is Greg's reading of the tea leaves. Pretty good.
Yes, yes. Not many tea leaves either. There's not, but I think it's important to look at Cisco because they are regarded as the bellwether and because they dominate the industry, you know, $12 billion in a quarter. Everything that they do, everything else in the industry sort of fits around it. You know, when the big fat lady sits down, all the water splashes out, you know, sort of thing. And so you can look at Cisco and you can interpret what's happening around the rest of the industry by, you know, seeing what that splash pattern looks like. And I think, you know, remember what I said about SD-WAN, enterprise routing market is slowing down. There is a transition to SD-WAN, but it's not going to recover the revenue that it used to get for those routers from years gone by, I don't think.
Yeah, it doesn't seem likely.
Yeah, so, you know, 10, 12, I think it's 10 or 11 consecutive quarters of decline in enterprise IT networking, basically. Should tell you something.
It should. All right, well, there's your analysis. This is our last story for the day, our surfing dog story. It's not really tech-related. It's more nerdy. Amazon Studios, that's the content wing of Amazon where they make films and TV shows. They're going hard for nerd-focused television. They're reportedly developing shows based on Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, which is a very popular cyberpunk novel, and the Ringworld trilogy by Larry Niven, which is one of my favorite sci-fi trilogies. And recently, the company reportedly spent $250 million to acquire television rights to Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, and they want to make TV shows based on, quote, previously unexplored stories in Middle-earth.
Thank goodness for my AWS. Thank goodness, all those people putting money into the cloud, I'm going to get a J.R.R. Tolkien Lord of the Rings.
They're producing Tolkien TV
all
for you.
All of a sudden, I'm in favor of AWS. I'm going to get entertainment based on snow. Yay for Is that too cynical?
No, I think, you know, Amazon wants to own everything, and they're rapidly working on it.
Until the government steps in and forces them to break up, like, you know, the late stage of the railroad barons and the telecoms barons of years gone by. Yes, that's true.
Well, let's hope we get some good TV out of it before then.
Small pickings.
That's true. It's not a great trade-off.
No, not really.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me expostulating on a regular basis on my Twitter handle as @etherealmind, and I'll be blogging more at packetpushers.net. I've got a whole bunch of stuff in the pipeline. I will have a mega article about OpenR spouting out some thoughts, and I've also been publishing some research papers, which you should be looking at on my personal blog at etherealmind.com.
All right. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm on Twitter at @Drew_CM. I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, ExtraHop and InnerOptics. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, share it around, put it on Facebook, tell your friends, leave a recommendation on iTunes. That really helps us.
Please leave us a rating on iTunes. We had something happened a couple of weeks ago. We had a huge spike in people joining us, which makes it so much easier for us to stay in business. So it would be really, really great if you could head over to your Apple Podcast app and just press stars, 5 stars. You don't even have to write something. Just say stars, and that helps us get into the store, into the ratings. As we made the weekly show made it to number 30 in the U.S. podcast store a few weeks back. Yeah.
That's impressive.
So we're regularly in the top 100. This is kind of getting a bit inside baseball. We're regularly in the top 100 for Network Break. I think Network Break's highest it's ever been is about 60. So it would be really great if we could actually spike. I think, although we did actually once get to number 20 in like Mali or something. So
Okay.
So really, if you could just, you know, next time you're in the app, go and give us some stars. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, we appreciate it. You can also check out our membership program. That's at packetpushers.net/members. It's free to sign up. You get the Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation newsletters, and we're going to be producing exclusive membership content as well. So go check it out, and thanks for listening.